lungs. The slow, thick drip into the pit of his stomach. All his organs awash in vomit. There was nothing that Rain could do about that. He knew what he had to do. The instruction manual directed him. He had to get to Comrade Pille. He no longer knew why. His feet took him to Lucky Press, which was locked, and then across the tiny yard to Comrade Pille's house. Just the effort of lifting his arm to knock exhausted him. Comrade Pille had finished his avial and was squashing a ripe banana, extruding the sludge through his closed fist into his plate of curd, when Velita knocked. He sent his wife to open the door. She returned looking sulky, and Comrade Pille thought, suddenly sexy. He wanted to touch her breast immediately. But he had curd on his fingers, and there was someone at the door. Kalyani sat on the bed and absentmindedly patted Lenin, who was asleep next to his tiny grandmother, sucking his thumb. "Who is it?" "That Pap and Parvin's son. He says it's urgent." Comrade Pille finished his curd, unhurriedly. He waggled his fingers over his plate. Kalyani brought water in a little stainless steel container and poured it out for him. The leftover morsels of food in his plate, a dry red chili and stiff angular brushes of sucked and spat out drumsticks, rose and floated. She brought him a hand towel. He wiped his hands, belched his appreciation, and went to the door. "Enda, at this time of the night?" As he replied, Velita heard his own voice beat back at him as though it had hit a wall. He tried to explain what had happened, but he could hear himself slipping into incoherence. The man he was talking to was small and far away, behind a wall of glass. "This is a little village," Comrade Pille was saying. "People talk. I listen to what they say. It's not as though I don't know what's been going on." Once again, Velita heard himself say something which made no difference to the man he spoke to. His own voice coiled around him like a snake. "Maybe," Comrade Pille said. "But comrade, you should know that party was not constituted to support workers in discipline in their private life." Velita watched Comrade Pille's body fade from the door. His disembodied, piping voice stayed on and sent out slogans, pennants fluttering in an empty doorway. "It is not in the party's interests to take up such matters. Individual's interest is subordinate to the organization's interest. Violating party discipline means violating party unity." The voice went on. Sentences disaggregated into phrases. Words. "Progress of the revolution. Annihilation of the class enemy. Comprador capitalist. Spring thunder." And there it was again. Another religion turned against itself. Another edifice constructed by the human mind, decimated by human nature. Comrade Pille shut the door and returned to his wife and dinner. He decided to eat another banana. "What did he want?" his wife asked, handing him one. "They found out. Someone must have told them. They've sacked him." "Is that all? He's lucky they haven't had him strung up from the nearest tree." "I noticed something strange," Comrade Pille said as he peeled his banana. "The fellow had red varnish on his nails." Standing outside in the rain, in the cold, wet light from the single street light, Velita was suddenly overcome by sleep. He had to force his eyelids to stay open. "Tomorrow," he told himself. "Tomorrow when the rain stops." His feet walked him to the river, as though they were the leash and he was the dog. History walking the dog. Chapter 15. The Crossing. It was past midnight. The river had risen, its water quick and black, snaking towards the sea, carrying with it cloudy night skies, a whole palm frond, part of a thatched fence, and other gifts the wind had given it. In a while the rain slowed to a drizzle and then stopped. The breeze shook water from the trees, and for a while it rained only under trees, where shelter had once been. A weak, watery moon filtered through the clouds and revealed a young man sitting on the topmost of 13 stone steps that led into the water. He was very still, very wet, very young. In a while he stood up, took off the white munda he was wearing, squeezed the water from it, and twisted it around his head like a turban. Naked now, he walked down the 13 stone steps into the water and further until the river was chest high. Then he began to swim with easy, powerful strokes, striking out towards where the current was swift and certain, where the really deep began. The moonlit river fell from his swimming arms like sleeves of silver. It took him only a few minutes to make the crossing. When he reached the other side, he emerged gleaming and pulled himself ashore, black as the night that surrounded him, black as the water he had crossed. He stepped onto the path that led through the swamp to the history house. He left no ripples in the water, no footprints on the shore. He held his munda spread above his head to dry. The wind lifted it like a sail. He was suddenly happy. "Things will get worse," he thought to himself. "Then better." He was walking swiftly now, towards the heart of darkness, as lonely as a wolf. The god of loss, the god of small things. Naked, but for his nail varnish. Chapter 16. A few hours later. Three children on the riverbank, a pair of twins, and another, whose mauve corduroy pinafore said "holiday" in a tilting happy font. Wet leaves in the trees shimmered like beaten metal. Dense clumps of yellow bamboo drooped into the river as though grieving in advance for what they knew was going to happen. The river itself was dark and quiet, an absence rather than a presence, betraying no sign of how high and strong it really was. Esther and Rahel dragged the boat out of the bushes where they usually hid it. The paddles that Velitha had made were hidden in a hollow tree. They set it down in the water and held it steady for Sophimol to climb in. They seemed to trust the darkness and moved up and down the glistening stone steps as sure-footed as young goats. Sophimol was more tentative, a little frightened of what lurked in the shadows around her. She had a cloth bag with food purloined from the fridge slung across her chest, bread, cake, biscuits. The twins, weighed down by their mother's words, "If it weren't for you, I would be free. I should have dumped you in an orphanage the day you were born. You're the millstones round my neck," carried nothing. Thanks to what the orange drink, lemon drink man did to Esther, their home away from home was already equipped. In the 2 weeks since Esther rode Scarlet Jam and thought two thoughts, they had squirreled away essential provisions, matches, potatoes, a battered saucepan, an inflatable goose, socks with multicolored toes, ballpoint pens with London buses, and the Qantas koala with loosened button eyes. "What if Amu finds us and begs us to come back?" "Then we will. But only if she begs," Esther the compassionate. Sophimol had convinced the twins that it was essential that she go along too, that the absence of children, all children, would heighten the adults' remorse. It would make them truly sorry, like the grown-ups in Hamelin after the Pied Piper took away all their children. They would search everywhere, and just when they were sure that all three of them were dead, they would return home in triumph, valued, loved, and needed more than ever. Her clinching argument was that if she were left behind, she might be tortured and forced to reveal their hiding place. Esther waited until Rahel got in, then took his place, sitting astride the little boat as though it were a seesaw. He used his legs to push the boat away from the shore. As they lurched into the deeper water, they began to row diagonally upstream, against the current, the way Velitha had taught them to. "If you want to end up there, you must aim There. In the dark, they couldn't see that they were in the wrong lane on a silent highway full of muffled traffic, that branches, logs, parts of trees were motoring towards them at some speed. They were past the really deep, only yards from the other side, when they collided with a floating log, and the little boat tipped over. It had happened to them often enough on previous expeditions across the river, and they would swim after the boat, and using it as a float, dog paddle to the shore. This time they couldn't see their boat in the dark. It was swept away in the current. They headed for the shore, surprised at how much effort it took them to cover that short distance. Esther managed to grab a low branch that arched down into the water. He peered downriver through the darkness to see if he could see the boat at all. "I can't see anything. It's gone." Rahel, covered in slush, clambered ashore and held a hand out to help Esther pull himself out of the water. It took them a few minutes to catch their breath and register the loss of the boat, to mourn its passing. "And all our food is spoiled," Rahel said to Sophie Moore, and was met with silence. A rushing, rolling, fish-swimming silence. "Sophie Moore," she whispered to the rushing river, "we're here, here, near the Ilimba tree." Nothing. On Rahel's heart, Papachi's moth snapped open its somber wings, out, in, and lifted its legs, up, down. They ran along the bank, calling out to her, but she was gone, carried away on the muffled highway, gray-green, with fish in it, with the sky and trees in it, and at night, the broken yellow moon in it. There was no storm music, no whirlpool spun up from the inky depths of the Meenachil, no shark supervised the tragedy. Just a quiet, handing-over ceremony, a boat spilling its cargo, a river accepting the offering, one small life, a brief sunbeam, with a silver thimble clenched for luck in its little fist. It was 4 in the morning, still dark, when the twins, exhausted, distraught, and covered in mud, made their way through the swamp and approached the history house. Hansel and Gretel, in a ghastly fairy tale in which their dreams would be captured and redreamed. They lay down in the back veranda on a grass mat with an inflatable goose and a Qantas koala bear. A pair of damp dwarves, numb with fear, waiting for the world to end. "Do you think she's dead by now?" Esther didn't answer. "What's going to happen?" "We'll go to jail." He jolly well knew, little man. He lived in a caravan, dum-dum. They didn't see someone else lying asleep in the shadows, as lonely as a wolf. A brown leaf on his black back that made the monsoons come on time. Chapter 17. Cochin Harbour Terminus. In his clean room in the dirty Imanam house, Esther, not old, not young, sat on his bed in the dark. He sat very straight, shoulders squared, hands in his lap, as though he was next in line for some sort of inspection, or waiting to be arrested. The ironing was done. It sat in a neat pile on the ironing board. He had done Rahel's clothes as well. It was raining steadily, night rain. That lonely drummer practicing his role long after the rest of the band has gone to bed. In the side mittum, by the separate men's needs entrance, the chrome tail fins of the old Plymouth gleamed momentarily in the lightning. For years after Chaco left for Canada, Baby Kochma had had it washed regularly. Twice a week for a small fee, Kochumaria's brother-in-law, who drove the yellow municipal garbage truck in Kortem, would drive into Imanam, heralded by the stench of Kortem's refuse, which lingered long after he had gone, to divest his sister-in-law of her salary and drive the Plymouth around to keep its battery charged. When she took up television, Baby Kochma dropped the car and the garden simultaneously. Tutti frutti. With every monsoon, the old car settled more firmly into the ground, like an angular, arthritic hen settling stiffly on her clutch of eggs, with no intention of ever getting up. Grass grew around its flat tires. The Paradise Pickles and Preserves signboard rotted and fell inward like a collapsed crown. A creeper stole a look at itself in the remaining mottled half of the cracked driver's mirror. A sparrow lay dead on the back seat. She had found her way in through a hole in the windscreen, tempted by some seat sponge for her nest. She never found her way out. No one noticed her panicked car window appeals. She died on the back seat with her legs in the air, like a joke. Gotcha Maria was asleep on the drawing room floor, curled into a coma in the flickering light of the television that was still on. American policemen were stuffing a handcuffed teenaged boy into a police car. There was blood spattered on the pavement. The police car lights flashed, and a siren wailed a warning. A wasted woman, the boy's mother perhaps, watched fearfully from the shadows. The boy struggled. They had used a mosaic blur on the upper part of his face so that he couldn't sue them. He had caked blood all over his mouth and down the front of his T-shirt, like a red bib. His baby pink lips were lifted off his teeth in a snarl. He looked like a werewolf. He screamed through the car window at the camera. "I'm 15 years old, and I wish I were a better person than I am, but I'm not. Do you want to hear my pathetic story?" He spat at the camera, and a missile of spit splattered over the lens and dribbled down. Baby Kuchma was in her room, sitting up in bed, filling in a Listerine discount coupon that offered a 2-rupee rebate on their new 500-milliliter bottle and 2,000-rupee gift vouchers to the lucky winners of their lottery. Giant shadows of small insects swooped along the walls and ceiling. To get rid of them, Baby Kuchma had put out the lights and lit a large candle in a tub of water. The water was already thick with singed carcasses. The candlelight accentuated her rouged cheeks and painted mouth. Her mascara was smudged. Her jewelry gleamed. She tilted the coupon towards the candle. "Which brand of mouthwash do you usually use?" "Listerine," Baby Kuchma wrote in a hand grown spidery with age. "State the reasons for your preference." She didn't hesitate. "Tangy taste. Fresh breath." She had learned the smart, snappy language of television commercials. She filled in her name and lied about her age. Under occupation, she wrote ornamental gardening, dip, Roche, USA. She put the coupon into an envelope marked Reliable Medicos Cortem. It would go with Gotcha Maria in the morning when she went into town on her best bakery cream bun expedition. Baby Kuchma picked up her maroon diary, which came with its own pen. She turned to 19th June and made a fresh entry. Her manner was routine. She wrote, "I love you, I love you." Every page in the diary had an identical entry. She had a case full of diaries with identical entries. Some said more than just that. Some had the day's accounts, to-do lists, snatches of favorite dialogue from favorite soaps. But even these entries all began with the same words, "I love you, I love you." Father Mulligan had died 4 years ago of viral hepatitis in an ashram north of Rishikesh. His years of contemplation of Hindu scriptures had led initially to theological curiosity, but eventually to a change of faith. 15 years ago, Father Mulligan became a Vaishnavite, a devotee of Lord Vishnu. He stayed in touch with Baby Kuchma even after he joined the ashram. He wrote to her every Diwali and sent her a greeting card every New Year. A few years ago, he sent her a photograph of himself addressing a gathering of middle-class Punjabi widows at a spiritual camp. The women were all in white, with their sari pallus drawn over their heads. Father Mulligan was in saffron, a yolk addressing a sea of boiled eggs. His white beard and hair were long, but combed and groomed. A saffron Santa with votive ash on his forehead. Baby Kuchma couldn't believe it. It was the only thing he ever sent her that she hadn't kept. She was offended by the fact that he had actually, eventually renounced his vows, but not for her, for other vows. It was like welcoming someone with open arms, only to have him walk straight past into someone else's. Father Mulligan's death did not alter the text of the entries in Baby Kochima's diary, simply because, as far as she was concerned, it did not alter his availability. If anything, she possessed him in death in a way that she never had while he was alive. At least her memory of him was hers, wholly hers, savagely, fiercely hers, not to be shared with Faith, far less with competing co-nuns and co-sadhus or whatever it was they called themselves, co-swamis. His rejection of her in life, gentle and compassionate though it was neutralized by death. In her memory of him, he embraced her, just her, in the way a man embraces a woman. Once he was dead, Baby Kochma stripped Father Mulligan of his ridiculous saffron robes and reclothed him in the Coca-Cola cassock she so loved. Her senses feasted, between changes, on that lean, concave, Christ-like body. She snatched away his begging bowl, pedicured his horny Hindu soles, and gave him back his comfortable sandals. She reconverted him into the high-stepping camel that came to lunch on Thursdays. And every night, night after night, year after year, in diary after diary after diary, she wrote, "I love you, I love you." She put the pen back into the pen loop and shut the diary. She took off her glasses, dislodged her dentures with her tongue, severing the strands of saliva that attached them to her gums like the sagging strings of a harp, and dropped them into a glass of Listerine. They sank to the bottom and sent up little bubbles like prayers. Her nightcap, a clenched smile soda, tangy teeth in the morning. Baby Kochma settled back on her pillow and waited to hear Rahel come out of Esther's room. They had begun to make her uneasy, both of them. A few mornings ago, she had opened her window for a breath of fresh air and caught them red-handed in the act of returning from somewhere. Clearly, they had spent the whole night out, together. Where could they have been? What and how much did they remember? When would they leave? What were they doing, sitting together in the dark for so long? She fell asleep, propped up against her pillows, thinking that perhaps, over the sound of the rain and the television, she hadn't heard Esther's door open. That Rahel had gone to bed long ago. She hadn't. Rahel was lying on Esther's bed. She looked thinner lying down, younger, smaller. Her face was turned towards the window beside the bed. Slanting rain hit the bars of the window grill and shattered into a fine spray over her face and her smooth, bare arm. Her soft, sleeveless t-shirt was a glowing yellow in the dark. The bottom half of her, in blue jeans, melted into the darkness. It was a little cold, a little wet, a little quiet, the air. But what was there to say? From where he sat at the end of the bed, Esther, without turning his head, could see her, faintly outlined, the sharp line of her jaw, her collarbones like wings that spread from the base of her throat to the ends of her shoulders, a bird held down by skin. She turned her head and looked at him. He sat very straight, waiting for the inspection. He had finished the ironing. She was lovely to him, her hair, her cheeks, her small, clever-looking hands. His sister. A nagging sound started up in his head, the sound of passing trains, the light and shade and light and shade that falls on you if you have a window seat. He sat even straighter. Still he could see her, grown into their mother's skin, the liquid glint of her eyes in the dark. Her small, straight nose, her mouth full-lipped, something wounded-looking about it, as though it was flinching from something, as though long ago someone, a man with rings, had hit her across it. A beautiful, hurt mouth. Their beautiful mother's mouth, Esther thought. Ammu's mouth. That had kissed his hand through the barred train window, first class on the Madras mail to Madras. Bye, Esther, God bless, Ammu's mouth had said, Ammu's trying not to cry mouth. The last time he had seen her. She was standing on the platform of the Cochin Harbour terminus, her face turned up to the train window. Her skin grey, wan, robbed of its luminous sheen by the neon station light. Daylight stopped by trains on either side, long corks that kept the darkness bottled in. The Madras Mail, the Flying Rani. Rahil held by Ammu's hand, a mosquito on a leash, a refugee stick insect in bata sandals. An airport ferry at a railway station. Stamping her feet on the platform, unsettling clouds of settled station filth. Until Ammu shook her and told her to stop it, and she stoppeted. Around them, the hustling, jostling crowd. Scurrying, hurrying, buying, selling, luggage trundling, porter paying, children shitting, people spitting, coming, going, begging, bargaining, reservation checking. Echoing station sounds. Hawkers selling coffee. Tea. Gaunt children, blonde with malnutrition, selling smutty magazines and food they couldn't afford to eat themselves. Melted chocolates. Cigarette sweets. Orange drinks, lemon drinks, Coca-Cola, Fanta, ice cream, rose milk. Pink-skinned dolls. Rattles. Love in Tokyo's. Hollow plastic parakeets full of sweets with heads you could unscrew. Yellow-rimmed red sunglasses. Toy watches with the time painted on them. A cart full of defective toothbrushes. The Cochin Harbour terminus. Grey in the station light. Hollow people, homeless, hungry, still touched by last year's famine. Their revolution postponed for the time being by Comrade EMS Nambudripad, Soviet stooge, running dog, the former apple of Peking's eye. The air was thick with flies. A blind man without eyelids and eyes as blue as faded jeans, his skin pitted with smallpox scars, chatted to a leper without fingers, taking dexterous drags from scavenged cigarette stubs that lay beside him in a heap. What about you? When did you move here? As though they'd had a choice. As though they had picked this for their home from a vast array of posh housing estates listed in a glossy pamphlet. A man sitting on a red weighing machine unstrapped his artificial leg, knee downwards, with a black boot, a nice white sock painted on it. The hollow, knobbled calf was pink, like proper calves should be. When you recreate the image of man, why repeat God's mistakes? Inside it, he stored his ticket, his towel, his stainless steel tumbler, his smells, his secrets, his love, his hope, his madness, his infinite joy. His real foot was bare. He bought some tea for his tumbler. An old lady vomited, a lumpy pool, and went on with her life. The station world, society's circus, where, with the rush of commerce, despair came home to roost and hardened slowly into resignation. But this time, for Ammu and her two-egg twins, there was no Plymouth window to watch it through, no net to save them as they vaulted through the circus air. Pack your things and leave, Chaco had said, stepping over a broken door, a handle in his hand. And Ammu, though her hands were trembling, hadn't looked up from her unnecessary hemming. A tin of ribbons lay open on her lap. But Rahel had looked up and seen that Chaco had disappeared and left a monster in his place. The thick-lipped man with rings, cool in white, bought scissors cigarettes from a platform vendor, three packs, to smoke in the train corridor. For men of action, satisfaction. He was Esther's escort, a family friend who happened to be going to Madras, Mr. Kurian Martin. Since there was going to be a grown-up with Esther anyway, Mamachi said there was no need to waste money on another ticket. Baba was buying Madras-Calcutta. Ammu was buying time. She too had to pack her things and leave, to start a new life in which she could afford to keep her children. Until then, it had been decided that one twin could stay in Imanam, not both. Together they were trouble. Natas ni reit se. They had to be separated. Maybe they're right, Amu's whisper said as she packed his trunk and hold all. Maybe a boy does need a baba. The thick-lipped man was in the coupe next to Esther's. He said he'd try and change seats with someone once the train started. For now, he left the little family alone. He knew that a hellish angel hovered over them, went where they went, stopped where they stopped, dripping wax from a bent candle. Everybody knew. It had been in the papers, the news of Sophie Moore's death, of the police encounter with a Paravan charged with kidnapping and murder, of the subsequent Communist Party siege of Paradise Pickles and Preserves, led by Imanam's own Crusader for Justice and spokesman of the oppressed. Comrade K.N.M. Pille claimed that the management had implicated the Paravan in a false police case because he was an active member of the Communist Party, that they wanted to eliminate him for indulging in lawful union activities. All that had been in the papers, the official version. Of course, the thick-lipped man with rings had no idea about the other version. The one in which a posse of touchable policemen crossed the Meenachal River, sluggish and swollen with recent rain, and picked their way through the wet undergrowth, clumping into the heart of darkness. Chapter 18. The History House. A posse of touchable policemen crossed the Meenachal River, sluggish and swollen with recent rain, and picked their way through the wet undergrowth, the clink of handcuffs in someone's heavy pocket. Their wide khaki shorts were rigid with starch and bobbed over the tall grass like a row of stiff skirts, quite independent of the limbs that moved inside them. There were six of them, servants of the state. Politeness, obedience, loyalty, intelligence, courtesy, efficiency. The Khotem police, a cartoon platoon. New age princes in funny pointed helmets, cardboard lined with cotton, hair oil stained, their shabby khaki crowns. Dark of heart, deadly purposed. They lifted their thin legs high, clumping through tall grass. Ground creepers snagged in their dew-damp leg hair. Burrs and grass flowers enhanced their dull socks. Brown millipedes slept in the soles of their steel-tipped, touchable boots. Rough grass left their legskin raw, crisscrossed with cuts. Wet mud farted under their feet as they squelched through the swamp. They trudged past darter birds on the tops of trees, drying their sodden wings spread out like laundry against the sky. Past egrets, cormorants, adjutant storks, Cyrus cranes looking for space to dance, purple herons with pitiless eyes, deafening their rack, 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 mother birds and their eggs. The early morning heat was full of the promise of worse to come. Beyond the swamp that smelled of still water, they walked past ancient trees cloaked in vines, gigantic money plants, wild pepper, cascading purple acuminous. Past a deep blue beetle balanced on an unbending blade of grass. Past giant spider webs that had withstood the rain and spread like whispered gossip from tree to tree. A banana flower sheathed in claret bracts hung from a scruffy, torn-leafed tree. A gem held out by a grubby schoolboy. A jewel in the velvet jungle. Crimson dragonflies mated in the air, double-deckered, deft. One admiring policeman watched and wondered briefly about the dynamics of dragonfly sex and what went into what. Then his mind clicked to attention and police thoughts returned. Onwards. Past tall anthills congealed in the rain, slumped like drugged sentries asleep at the gates of paradise. Past butterflies drifting through the air like happy messages, huge ferns, the chameleon, a startling shoe flower, the scurry of grey jungle fowl running for cover. The nutmeg tree that Velyapappan hadn't found. A forked canal. Still. Choked with duckweed. Like a dead green snake. A tree trunk fallen over it. The touchable policeman minced across, twirling polished bamboo batons. Hairy fairies with lethal wands. Then the sunlight was fractured by thin trunks of tilting trees, dark of hardness, tiptoed into the heart of darkness. The sound of stridulating crickets swelled. Grey squirrels streaked down mottled trunks of rubber trees that slanted towards the sun, old scars slashed across their bark, sealed, healed, untapped. Acres of this. And then a grassy clearing. A house. The history house. Whose doors were locked and windows open, with cold stone floors and billowing ship-shaped shadows on the walls, where waxy ancestors with tough toenails and breath that smelled of yellow maps whispered papery whispers, where translucent lizards lived behind old paintings, where dreams were captured and redreamed, where an old Englishman ghost, sickled to a tree, was abrogated by a pair of two-egg twins. A mobile republic with a puff who had planted a Marxist flag in the earth beside him. As the platoon of policemen minced past, they didn't hear him beg, in his kind, missionary voice. "Excuse me, would you, you wouldn't happen to, I don't suppose you'd have a cigar on you? No? No, I didn't think so." The History House. Where, in the years that followed, the terror, still to come, would be buried in a shallow grave, hidden under the happy humming of hotel cooks, the humbling of old communists, the slow death of dancers, the toy histories that rich tourists came to play with. It was a beautiful house. White-walled once, red-roofed, but painted in weather colors now, with brushes dipped in nature's palette, moss green, earth brown, crumble black, making it look older than it really was. Like sunken treasure dredged up from the ocean bed, whale-kissed and barnacled, swaddled in silence, breathing bubbles through its broken windows. A deep veranda ran all around. The rooms themselves were recessed, buried in shadow, the tiled roof swept down like the sides of an immense upside-down boat. Rotting beams, supported on once white pillars, had buckled at the center, leaving a yawning, gaping hole. A history hole. A history-shaped hole in the universe, through which, at twilight, dense clouds of silent bats billowed like factory smoke and drifted into the night. They returned at dawn with news of the world, a gray haze in the rosy distance that suddenly coalesced and blackened over the house before it plummeted through the history hole like smoke in a film running backwards. All day they slept, the bats, lining the roof like fur, spattering the floors with shit. The policeman stopped and fanned out. They didn't really need to, but they liked these touchable games. They positioned themselves strategically, crouching by the broken, low stone boundary wall. Quick piss, hot foam on warm stone, police piss, drowned ants in yellow bubbly. Deep breaths. Then, together, on their knees and elbows, they crept towards the house, like film policemen, softly, softly through the grass. Batons in their hands, machine guns in their minds. Responsibility for the touchable future on their thin but able shoulders. They found their quarry in the back veranda. A spoiled puff, a fountain in a Love in Tokyo, and in another corner, as lonely as a wolf, a carpenter with blood-red nails. Asleep, making nonsense of all that touchable cunning. The surprise swoop, the headlines in their heads, desperado caught in police dragnet. For this insolence, this spoiling the fun, their quarry paid, oh yes. They woke Velitha with their boots. Esthapen and Rahel woke to the shout of sleep, surprised by shattered kneecaps. Screams died in them and floated belly up like dead fish. Cowering on the floor, rocking between dread and disbelief, they realized that the man being beaten was Velitha. Where had he come from? What had he done? Why had the policeman brought him here? They heard the thud of wood on flesh, boot on bone, on teeth, the muffled grunt when a stomach is kicked in, the muted crunch of skull on cement, the gurgle of blood on a man's breath when his lung is torn by the jagged end of a broken rib. Blue-lipped and dinner-plate-eyed, they watched, mesmerized by something that they sensed but didn't understand. The absence of caprice in what the policeman did. The abyss where anger should have been. The sober, steady brutality. The economy of it all. They were opening a bottle, or shutting a tap, cracking an egg to make an omelette. The twins were too young to know that these were only history's henchmen, sent to square the books and collect the dues from those who broke its laws, impelled by feelings that were primal, yet paradoxically wholly impersonal, feelings of contempt born of inchoate, unacknowledged fear, civilization's fear of nature, men's fear of women, power's fear of powerlessness, man's subliminal urge to destroy what he could neither subdue nor deify. Men's needs. What Esthapen and Rahel witnessed that morning, though they didn't know it then, was a clinical demonstration in controlled conditions. This was not war, after all, or genocide, of human nature's pursuit of ascendancy. Structure, order, complete monopoly. It was human history, masquerading as God's purpose, revealing herself to an underage audience. There was nothing accidental about what happened that morning, nothing incidental. It was no stray mugging or personal settling of scores. This was an era imprinting itself on those who lived in it. History in live performance. If they hurt Velitha more than they intended to, it was only because any kinship, any connection between themselves and him, any implication that if nothing else, at least biologically, he was a fellow creature, had been severed long ago. They were not arresting a man. They were exorcising fear. They had no instrument to calibrate how much punishment he could take, no means of gauging how much or how permanently they had damaged him. Unlike the custom of rampaging religious mobs or conquering armies running riot, that morning in the heart of darkness, the posse of touchable policemen acted with economy, not frenzy. Efficiency, not anarchy. Responsibility, not hysteria. They didn't tear out his hair or burn him alive. They didn't hack off his genitals and stuff them in his mouth. They didn't rape him or behead him. After all, they were not battling an epidemic. They were merely inoculating a community against an outbreak. In the back veranda of the History House, as the man they loved was smashed and broken, Mrs. Epen and Mrs. Rajagopalan, twin ambassadors of God knows what, learned two new lessons. Lesson number one. Blood barely shows on a black man. Dumb, dumb. And lesson number two. It smells, though. Sick sweet. Like old roses on a breeze. Dumb, dumb.
Madhya, one of history's agents asked.
Madhyarikim, another replied.
Enough?
Enough.
They stepped away from him. Craftsmen assessing their work, seeking aesthetic distance. Their work, abandoned by God and history, by Marx, by man, by woman, and in the hours to come, by children, lay folded on the floor. He was semi-conscious, but wasn't moving. His skull was fractured in three places. His nose and both his cheekbones were smashed, leaving his face pulpy, undefined. The blow to his mouth had split open his upper lip and broken six teeth,
three of which were embedded in his lower lip, hideously inverting his beautiful smile. Four of his ribs were splintered. One had pierced his left lung, which was what made him bleed from his mouth. The blood on his breath, bright red, fresh, frothy. His lower intestine was ruptured and hemorrhaged, the blood collected in his abdominal cavity. His spine was damaged in two places. The concussion had paralyzed his right arm and resulted in a loss of control over his bladder and rectum. Both his kneecaps were shattered. Still, they brought out the handcuffs. Cold. With the sour metal smell. Like steel bus rails and the bus conductor's hands from holding them. That was when they noticed his painted nails. One of them held them up and waved the fingers coquettishly at the others. They laughed.
"What's this?"
in a high falsetto.
"ACDC?"
One of them flicked at his penis with his stick.
"Come on, show us your special secret. Show us how big it gets when you blow it up."
Then he lifted his boot, with millipedes curled into its sole, and brought it down with a soft thud. They locked his arms across his back. Click. And click. Below a lucky leaf, an autumn leaf at night, that made the monsoons come on time. He had goosebumps where the handcuffs touched his skin.
"It isn't him," Rahil whispered to Esther. "I can tell. It's his twin brother, Urumban, from Kochi."
Unwilling to seek refuge in fiction, Esther said nothing. Someone was speaking to them, a kind, touchable policeman. Kind to his kind.
"Mon, Morl, are you all right? Did he hurt you?"
And not together, but almost, the twins replied in a whisper.
"Yes. No."
"Don't worry. You're safe with us now."
Then the policeman looked around and saw the grass mat, the pots and pans, the inflatable goose, the Qantas koala with loosened button eyes, the ballpoint pens with London streets in them, socks with separate colored toes, yellow-rimmed red plastic sunglasses, a watch with the time painted on it.
"Whose are these?
Where did they come from? Who brought them?"
An edge of worry in the voice.
Esther and Rahel, full of fish, stared back at him. The policemen looked at one another. They knew what they had to do. The Qantas koala they took for their children, and the pens and socks. Police children with multicolored toes. They burst the goose with a cigarette, bang, and buried the rubber scraps. Useless goose, too recognizable. The glasses one of them wore, the others laughed, so he kept them on for a while. The watch they all forgot. It stayed behind in the history house, in the back veranda. A faulty record of the time, 10 to 2. They left. Six princes, their pockets stuffed with toys, a pair of two-egg twins, and the god of loss. He couldn't walk, so they dragged him. Nobody saw them. Bats, of course, are blind.
Chapter 19. Saving Ammu.
At the police station, Inspector Thomas Matthew sent for two Coca-Colas. With straws. A servile constable brought them on a plastic tray and offered them to the two muddy children sitting across the table from the inspector, their heads only a little higher than the mess of files and papers on it. So once again, in the space of 2 weeks, bottled fear for Esther. Chilled. Fizzed. Sometimes things went worse with Cook. The fizz went up his nose. He burped. Rahel giggled. She blew through her straw till the drink bubbled over onto her dress, all over the floor. Esther read aloud from the board on the wall.
"Senatilop," he said. "Senatilop. Ekne debo. Italiol. Ekne giletini," Rahel said. Iset truok.
Ik nei kifi.
To his credit, Inspector Thomas Matthew remained calm. He sensed the growing incoherence in the children. He noted the dilated pupils. He had seen it all before. The human mind's escape valve. Its way of managing trauma. He made allowances for that and couched his questions cleverly, innocuously. Between, when is your birthday, Mon? And, what's your favorite color, Mon? Gradually, in a fractured, disjointed fashion, things began to fall into place. His men had briefed him about the pots and pans, the grass mat, the impossible-to-forget toys. They began to make sense now. Inspector Thomas Matthew was not amused. He sent a jeep for baby Gutrima. He made sure that the children were not in the room when she arrived. He didn't greet her. "Have a seat," he said. Baby Gutrima sensed that something was terribly wrong. "Have you found them? Is everything all right?" "Nothing is all right," the inspector assured her. From the look in his eyes and the tone of his voice, Baby Gutrima realized that she was dealing with a different person this time. Not the accommodating police officer of their previous meeting. She lowered herself into a chair. Inspector Thomas Matthew didn't mince his words. The Korten police had acted on the basis of an FIR filed by her. The Padawan had been caught. Unfortunately, he had been badly injured in the encounter and in all likelihood would not live through the night. But now the children said that they had gone of their own volition. Their boat had capsized, and the English child had drowned by accident, which left the police saddled with the death in custody of a technically innocent man. True, he was a Padawan. True, he had misbehaved. But these were troubled times, and technically, as per the law, he was an innocent man. There was no case.
Attempted rape?
Baby Kuchma suggested weakly. Where is the rape victim's complaint? Has it been filed? Has she made a statement? Have you brought it with you? The inspector's tone was belligerent, almost hostile. Baby Kuchma looked as though she had shrunk. Pouches of flesh hung from her eyes and jowls. Fear fermented in her, and the spit in her mouth turned sour. The inspector pushed a glass of water towards her. The matter is very simple. Either the rape victim must file a complaint, or the children must identify the Padawan as their abductor in the presence of a police witness, or... He waited for Baby Kuchma to look at him. Or, I must charge you with lodging a false FIR. Criminal offense. Sweat stained Baby Kuchma's light blue blouse dark blue. Inspector Thomas Matthew didn't hustle her. He knew that given the political climate, he himself could be in very serious trouble. He was aware that Comrade K&M Pillay would not pass up this opportunity. He kicked himself for acting so impulsively. He used his printed hand towel to reach inside his shirt and wipe his chest and armpits. It was quiet in his office. The sounds of police station activity, the clumping of boots, the occasional howl of pain from somebody being interrogated, seemed distant, as though they were coming from somewhere else. The children will do as they're told, Baby Kuchma said. If I could have a few moments alone with them. As you wish, the inspector rose to leave the office. Please give me 5 minutes before you send them in. Inspector Thomas Matthew nodded his assent and left. Baby Kuchma wiped her shining, sweaty face. She stretched her neck, looking up at the ceiling, in order to wipe the sweat from crevices between her rolls of neck fat with the end of her ballu. She kissed her crucifix. Hail Mary, full of grace. The words of the prayer deserted her. The door opened. Esther and Rahel were ushered in, caked with mud, drenched in Coca-Cola. The sight of Baby Kuchma made them suddenly sober. The moth with unusually dense dorsal tufts spread its wings over both their hearts. Why had she come? Where was Ammu? Was she still locked up? Baby Kuchma looked at them sternly. She said nothing for a long time. When she spoke, her voice was hoarse and unfamiliar.
Whose boat was it? Where did you get it from?
Ours? That we found? Velitha mended it for us, Rahel whispered.
How long have you had it?
We found it the day Sofimol came.
And you stole things from the house and took them across the river in it?
We were only playing.
Playing? Is that what you call it?
Baby Kochma looked at them for a long time before she spoke again.
Your lovely little cousin's body is lying in the drawing room. The fish have eaten out her eyes. Her mother can't stop crying. Is that what you call playing?
A sudden breeze made the flowered window curtain billow. Outside, Rahel could see jeeps parked and walking people. A man was trying to start his motorcycle. Each time he jumped on the kickstarter lever, his helmet slipped to one side. Inside the inspector's room, Papachi's moth was on the move.
It's a terrible thing to take a person's life, Baby Kochma said. It's the worst thing that anyone can ever do. Even God doesn't forgive that.
You know that, don't you? Two heads nodded twice. And yet, she looked sadly at them. You did it. She looked them in the eye. You are murderers. She waited for this to sink in.
You know that I know that it wasn't an accident. I know how jealous of her you were. And if the judge asks me in court, I'll have to tell him, won't I? I can't tell a lie, can I?
She patted the chair next to her. Here, come and sit down. Four cheeks of two obedient bottoms squeezed into it.
I'll have to tell them how it was strictly against the rules for you to go alone to the river. How you forced her to go with you, although you knew that she couldn't swim. How you pushed her out of the boat in the middle of the river. It wasn't an accident, was it?
Four saucers stared back at her, fascinated by the story she was telling them. Then what happened?
So now you'll have to go to jail, Baby Kochma said kindly. And your mother will go to jail because of you. Would you like that?
Frightened eyes and a fountain looked back at her. Three of you in three different jails. Do you know what jails in India are like?
Two heads shook twice.
Baby Kochma built up her case. She drew, from her imagination, vivid pictures of prison life. The cockroach crisp food, the chichi piled in the toilets like soft brown mountains, the bed bugs, the beatings. She dwelled on the long years Amu would be put away because of them. How she would be an old sick woman with lice in her hair when she came out, if she didn't die in jail, that was. Systematically, in her kind, concerned voice, she conjured up the macabre future in store for them. When she had stamped out every ray of hope, destroyed their lives completely, like a fairy godmother, she presented them with a solution. God would never forgive them for what they had done. But here on Earth, there was a way of undoing some of the damage, of saving their mother from humiliation and suffering on their account, provided they were prepared to be practical.
Luckily, Baby Kochma said, luckily for you, the police have made a mistake, a lucky mistake. She paused.
You know what it is, don't you?
There were people trapped in the glass paperweight on the policeman's desk. Esther could see them. A waltzing man and a waltzing woman. She wore a white dress with legs underneath.
Don't you?
There was paperweight waltz music. Mamachi was playing it on her violin. Ra 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 rum, pa rum, pa rum.
The thing is, Baby Kuchma's voice was saying, what's done is done. The inspector says he's going to die anyway, so it won't really matter to him what the police think. What matters is whether you want to go to jail and make Amu go to jail because of you. It's up to you to decide that. There were bubbles inside the paperweight, which made the man and woman look as though they were waltzing underwater. They looked happy.